And the theme is on the sexual revolution, answering this sexual revolution. And of course, this is a daunting task of for many reasons. Of course, it's a huge subject. It's very complex. There are many, many different issues related to the sexual revolution. So that's one challenge for me. Another challenge is that I have been speaking on this issue a number of times here at the forum, and I'm afraid some of you have heard presentations a number of times. Thanks. So I don't want to just repeat myself. On Focal Online, you can find a number of presentations I have dealing with different issues. Let's begin with the historical roots. Our culture have changed dramatically during the last couple of decades. Very quick and very deep change in terms of how we view family, marriage, love, sex, the body, relationships, procreation, children. It's a huge area where our perspective and understanding and practices have radically changed. When people think about that change and are thinking of the roots, a lot of people think, oh, they go back to Sweden and you accuse my country. And there's some truth to that, because the sexual revolution became very visible in the 60s, and Sweden and Denmark took the lead in that development of more publicly giving expressions of that, and Swedish sin became an expression. And Anita Ekberg, Swedish actress, world famous sex symbol, she became a star through the famous movie La Dolce Vita. Many film critics use that as one of the most important films of the 20th century. And that film is an expression of the sexual revolution. The film starts by two helicopters flying over Rome. The first helicopter, under it, there is a huge statue of Christ. And the statue is going, they are moving the statue from one museum to another, or from one church to another, I don't remember which. In the second helicopter, just behind, there is a group of journalists, four or five young male journalists. Their assignment is to follow this move of the Christ statue. They fly on low over Rome, and they pass over a hotel, and on the hotel roof there is a swimming pool. And around the pool there are a number of young, beautiful women in bikinis. So much more interesting than a statue of Christ. So they immediately talk to the pilot, and the helicopter starts to move around the hotel roof, and Christ disappears. Very, very obvious symbol. So there are roots back to the 60s, but that's not the actual roots. In order to understand the sexual revolution, you need to go back to Austria and to Germany in the 20s and in the 30s. And the phrase itself, the sexual revolution, comes from a very strange German man, Wilhelm Reich, who published a book, The Sexual Revolution, and whose life mission was to undermine the traditional understanding of sexuality. He said, tradition, quote, is the dead trying to suffocate the living. So tradition is just taking life out of us, especially in the area of sexuality. So we need to get rid of tradition. And we need to realize that we live in a world with, quote, no meta-empirical authority of values. There is nothing beyond us that forces us to think or live in a certain way. There are no values beyond ourselves. So we are not bound by this tradition or by Christianity. And he wanted to see a revolution. And very practically, that meant for Reich that he wanted to see the abolition of lifelong monogamous marriage. Of course, you were allowed to form that kind of relationship, but not as an ideal. You could also have other relationships. You can have sex in other contexts than a lifelong monogamous marriage. He wanted to encourage infantile and adolescent sexuality. Sex is a natural biological phenomenon. It's with us from childhood and onwards. Why say it's just between adults? Why can't young people have sex? Why can't children have sex? It's a natural thing. We eat and sleep and breathe, and why don't we have sex? It's a destructive thing to try to suppress sexuality and say no to sexual impulses. Then you just press them inside yourself and they will come out somewhere else or in some other ways. The whole category of sexual perversion should be eliminated. The perverse is something which is beside the way it should be, normality or the right way. So you have what is perverse and that's condemned. But we cannot make that kind of definitions. There is no such thing as the perverse. There's just a variety of ways you can express yourself or you can express sexuality. And if you look at this list, you have to say that Reich's revolution has been very successful. With one exception, I would say. We are almost stricter today in terms of children and sexuality. And pedophilia is viewed as a perversion. But on nearly all the other areas, Reich's revolution is moving on in our culture, shaping how people think. Reich was inspired by people like Sigmund Freud. And Freud has a sophisticated formulation. He describes what he called polymorphous perversity. Poly is many. And morphous has been form, so a many-folded perversity. What does he mean by that? He means this. A child does not know taboos, does not know the difference between normality and the perverse. But for a child, the world just appears in its variety. So a child does not understand the difference between having sex with a human and having sex with an animal, or having sex with one's parents, or having sex with someone outside the family, or having sex with someone of the same sex or with the opposite sex. All those things are added into the child's life through culture, through education, through socialization. From the beginning, human beings are what society would say perverse. They are open for everything. So that is the kind of natural state for the human being. But if one wants to understand this sexual revolution, it's not Sweden, it's not Germany. We have to blame another country. We need to go to the Enlightenment and the French Revolution. And if one read about the roots of the sexual revolution, historians trace it back to Marquis de Sade, the French nobleman, whose life was not very noble, who understood the philosophical implications of the atheistic Enlightenment. There is no God, there is no moral framework above us. And we are therefore free. Whatever can be done, what whatever can be done, we are allowed to do. There are no real limits. And of course, it is from his name we have the word sadism, to have sexual pleasure from inflicting pain on someone else, enjoying that. And that was one of the things he himself enjoyed. He published some of the worst literature in Western history, which is a strange mixture of pornography and then philosophical motivations for the pornography. So he was really aware of the philosophical implications, and he then practiced that in his own life in a very tragic way. So the roots goes back to the Enlightenment and to philosophically naturalism, the rejection of God, of the transcendent, of the spiritual, and the limit of reality to nature, what is physically here. And then, of course, out from naturalism, very natural, you can say, individualism follows. Who then should decide what is right and wrong? Well, there is no one above the individual. And the individual is totally free. There are no limits morally for what you can choose. So I think here we have the roots. And it is the same roots as we see in so many other areas of secular Europe, but they are really, it's really clear in terms of the sexual revolution. They go back here, and individualism is what is driving it now. The process from the Enlightenment to contemporary society has been, of course, a long, slow process. It has taken a lot of time, but I think we can say that the implications of what Sade was thinking, they are really with us today. So, second point. Let's look at this gradual change. I want to start by saying it was not a good situation in terms of sexuality and relationships before the sexual revolution. So it's not that we had a golden past, and then, unfortunately, this evil revolution took place and everything was destroyed. It was a really mixed situation at the time of the Enlightenment, and a lot of bad things in relationship to how people thought about sex. One can think about the enormous amount of brothels in the Christian Europe where men bought sex. You can think of the lack of knowledge about bodily functions and about sexuality in many places. People were ashamed of talking openly about this area of life. There was a neglect of female sexuality, so it was the focus on men's sexuality and men's pleasure and so on. So a lot of things needed to be changed, for sure. So it's not from a paradise to a catastrophe, but from a problematic situation, and then someone coming in with a revolution that has made some things better, but most things even worse. We still have all the brothels, don't we? So, I want to underline that so we think of this in the right way. But there's been really drastic and destructive consequences in terms of the view of marriage. At the year 1900, 2% of marriages in Sweden ended in divorce. Now it's over 50%. That's a huge, huge cultural difference. With so much pain, and so much social and personal consequences. In terms of children, not being able to grow up in relationship with their biological parents. We can think of the whole view in terms of insemination. Single women and lesbian women have the right in Sweden to insemination. The child has no right even to know the identity of the father until they are 18 years old. So the state now withdraw the right for children to have a relationship with and even knowledge with their biological origin, 50% of their biological origin. That is a huge thing in terms of children's life. And this would be unthinkable in previous times. We can see, of course, in the whole concept of love and sex, dramatic changes. Of course, we still see people who are in love and having sex and makes a connection between love and sex. But we also see this radical separation where you can have sex totally without love or commitment. We see the whole dating world, which is discussed quite a lot these days, how strange the dating world has become. And how many people, how many relationships and how many dates people can go to, but how difficult it is to form long-term, committed, healthy relationships. And of course, we have the whole dramatic change with all these letters. LGBTQIA+. We have other letters in Swedish, so this is very, very difficult for me to. And we have all those issues are relating to sexual identity, which is a new situation. In England, one of the parliamentarians was recently scandalized, and you know why? He said on a political conference, a number of conservatives, thinkers and politicians and so were gathered, and publicly he said this: the normative family, held together by marriage, by mother and father, sticking together for the sake of the children and the sake of their own parents and for the sake of themselves, this is the only possible basis for a safe and successful society. That was really brave. To say publicly, and of course, the Prime Minister went after him, his own party went after him. A number of decades ago, so many people would just take this for granted. Say, of course, there are freedom for individuals to form, but the basis of society is this and must be this. And now you cannot publicly say it without being viewed as a kind of heretic. That's a good illustration of how drastically our society has changed. In terms of the negative consequences of the sexual revolution, I have gathered a lot of statistics from Sweden. You can look into your own country. What's actually happening in this area? One of the most obvious areas is what became so visible in the Me Too movement. We have really not solved the issue of sexuality and how to relate to each other sexually. The sexual revolution has opened the door for a lot of negative things. Sweden is one of the countries most affected by the sexual revolution. Have a guess, in which country were the Me Too movement the biggest movement? Sweden. Yeah, there's a connection. And of course, there is now a number of people who are voicing criticism, not only from a Christian perspective of the sexual revolution, but from other perspectives, because some of the negative consequences are very obvious. Francis Fukuyama, famous for his book, The End of History, in a later book, it's called the Great Disruption, which is his term for the last 50 years, last 5 decades, one of the greatest frauds perpetrated during the Great Disruption was the notion that the sexual revolution was gender neutral, benefiting women and men equally, and that it somehow had a kinship with the feminist revolution. In fact, the sexual revolution served the interests of men and in the end put sharp limits on the gains that women otherwise have expected from their liberation from traditional roles. That's interesting. Social critic just putting into words what's happening here. Yesterday in the presentation from Julia Garshagen, she referred to Louise Perry's book, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. I highly recommend that book. A non-Christian woman analyzing with a lot of, she has a lot of experience in working with women who have suffered under the sexual revolution. Behind the whole sexual revolution is, of course, the loss of design, since its roots goes back to naturalism and to individualism. So our culture has lost the whole concept of design. We don't believe in a God who has designed the universe, and we don't believe any longer in a revelation from God, that God has communicated anything about his thoughts, because he's not there, so there are no thoughts to be communicated. So we don't have his word to guide us and give us instructions, and there is no real meaning in trying to decode what nature tells us, because nature has no, there's no conscious design, intellectual design even behind nature. So even if from an evolutionary perspective you could say there is some kind of design in terms of how evolution works and selects what has possibility to live and what is fit for the environment and so on, that kind of design is without any obligation for us. So even if you can say, well, from an evolutionary perspective, procreation is the whole point of human sexuality. That is what biologists would say, procreation, that's the background for our sexuality. Evolution has designed it, so we procreate that way and humanity lives on. But there's no need for us. There's no obligation for us to make a connection between procreation and sex. So we are free to put them apart. And of course we have technical tools to do it in terms of contraception and the pill and so on. So people have nowhere to look for an understanding of sexuality. There's no meaning look to nature, and you have no written revelation from God to look to. Then the only place you can look is to go inside to your own feeling. What do I want? What do my feelings tell me? And that is now guiding almost the whole culture, the feeling of the individual. And that leads me to the fourth point, the loss of rational discourse. And now we come into the real problematic for us here. So we have a culture that had moved away to a totally different understanding of sexuality. And here we stand with the biblical understanding of sexuality. And we want to be part of society, we want to have a dialogue with society, and we want to make a case for our understanding of the body and sex and relationship and love. And society is dismissing to a high degree rational discourse in this area. And this is so frustrating. And we are not met with arguments, but with accusations and strong feelings when we try to have a conversation about these issues. I was reminded of an old article, almost 20 years old, by a British philosopher who were criticizing postmodernism, and he took as an example a medieval form of castle and a medieval way of defending yourself. And English speakers here, how do you pronounce Morten Bailey Castle? Okay. And you see how it's structured. It's structured in a very smart way. So you have a beautiful area here with a lot of freedom, and you can grow things there. And but you are vulnerable there for enemies. They can attack you. As an example, some violent, strong people. That's for sure. So then they had built a dark and closed tower. So if the Vikings are coming, all the people out here in the field can just retreat up there. And it's almost impossible for the Vikings to get them. Okay, it's a very smart way of defending yourself and isolating yourself, you can say, from the enemy. And this philosopher took that as an example of what's happening in postmodern philosophy. They are not open for rational discourse any longer, but they have this Morten Bailey castle where they retreat into a dark tower of relativism, and you cannot have the conversation any longer. The article is worth reading. And he's very ironic. What should I call these philosophers? Is it logophobia? They are afraid of logos. He discussed that, and then he says, now I will call it alogosia. They just ignore logos. And I think we are in that kind of situation that so much of our culture, as soon as you want to have a rational discussion, everyone moves into the dark tower of individualism and of feelings and of accusations and the conversation breaks down. So this makes it really difficult. And all through the discussion, there are so many inconsistencies and contradictions. And when you try to point them out, people just flee up to the tower and they don't address what you want to discuss. Let me take you an example. I read a Swedish psychiatrist, he's a very high up in the academic world. He, a number of years ago, he wrote a book called Perversity, going through all different kinds of sexual interests and sexual identities and sexual, whatever can be in the area of sexuality among human beings. It was a long list. So he mentioned dendrophilia. I had to acknowledge I've not heard of it before. Dendrophilia it's not very common, but a few people have their sexuality related to things, and in this case, to trees. And it happens, I read that book, and the same month there was an interview in the biggest Swedish newspaper of a young girl who said she was a dendrophile. So she went out in the woods to relate to trees sexually. And she brought home a trees to have in her room. So she relates sexually to a thing, not to a person. Now, most people would have no problem if I'm saying, okay, it's a free country, she's free to relate to trees. But there's something tragic. She's a person, that is a thing. She's a woman, she can conceive children. The fullness of her body, of her femaleness, of her sexuality, cannot be expressed in relationship to a tree. It would be richer, more meaningful, more right in some sense, if we could help her to relate to a person, to a man. The fullness of who she is could be expressed in another way if it was a man and not a tree. Most people wouldn't have a lot of problem with that. But if I are using the same kind of reasoning in relationship to homosexuality, I'm burned at the stake. The thinking is identical. And people refuse to address why is it okay to reason in that case, but not in that case. Or if we think about LGBTQIA+, intersexuality, asexuality, and plus for all the other possible sexual identities. There is an inherent contradiction in how the Pride movement are dealing with those issues, and no journalists ask any questions ever about this. So, lesbian and gay, that's a fixed identity. Bisexuality is a very flexible identity moving between the different poles. Q, there's no given identity, and you can create and recreate and change your identity all the time. And T, there's a fixed inner identity, but within a wrong body. Now, what's the anthropology behind this? Or think of everyone culturally defends same-sex marriage, but they reject polygamy in legal terms. Now, of course, there's a trend now of the polyamorous. It's quite big. But there's not much push for changing the marriage laws. Again, there is no coherence in the thinking in those areas. You cannot read that. Well, Martin can. It's Swedish. Even within the churches, there are now, the very liberal churches, there is now a push for polyamorous relationships, saying, well, if we are created by God with the possibility of love, of loving several persons at the same time, why shouldn't we express that? Okay, so this makes it very difficult that the whole culture is so incoherent, and they come away with it because the basis is the individual's feeling, and you are not allowed to question that, and then you just have to live with all those inconsistencies because the individual is just expressing, different individuals are expressing different things. Shortly, an evangelical response, and then you will have your challenge. Primarily, we will give a moral response, not a legal. Of course, in some issues, there will be legal dimensions that we would be interested to voice. But generally, we are for a free society. And if you look in the New Testament, the first Christians were not out to change the legal system in the first place, but to, of course, win people for Christ and then help them to live according to the will of God. What we would argue as evangelicals is that the biblical view of sex does not have all the internal contradictions that the sexual revolution has, and that it makes a real sense of human experience in its fullness, not just on one isolated point, but in the fullness of being a human being and living a human life. For example, I often take the example of Erika Jong and her book Fear of Flying, which was a cult book in the 70s. Feminists and radical people read it. It promoted the sexual revolution to have free sex. And she was the one who invented the expression the simplest fuck as an expression for free sex. She was back in Sweden 37 years after her book. And she was asked, the simplest fuck, what do you say about it 37 years later? It does not exist in reality, just as a fantasy. sex always causes some kind of relationship. That's interesting. She was the prophet of the sexual revolution. And now she says what Christians always have said. I often take the example of the legal system that we make a distinction between between assault and sexual assault. Why have we a distinction in a legal system between two different kinds of bodily assaults? Why not just have one legal concept? You are not allowed to hurt someone else's body. If it is a fist in the stomach, or if it's rape, what's the difference? Well, everyone knows there is a difference. There's a huge difference because sexuality is a unique act with totally different significance and ramifications. You're not traumatized by having someone punching you in the stomach. 15 years later, you're not thinking about that. But we know what sexual assault and rape is doing to people. It's a different kind of action or event. Or Tom Cruise, he stars in the film Vanilla Sky, and he starts a relationship with Cameron Diaz. Well, she has another name in the movie, Julia. But then, of course, he starts another relationship with another beautiful woman. When Julia discovers that, she says, "Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" That's quite deep for being a movie with Tom Cruise. The Christian view validates life's most important dimensions: relationships, love, new generation. What's over a lifetime is significant is guarded within the Christian understanding of sex and marriage and the body. And the Christian understanding, of course, follows from the logic of belief in a creator. We believe that life is designed, and that there is meaning to our existence, to our body, to sexuality, to our different functions. So we take design seriously. And of course, we have a view that is informed by Scripture. And we would say the design of reality and the information we have in Scripture goes so well together. It fits together, and it makes a meaningful whole.